The monologue.
We're being told that the situation at hospitals in Washington State due to COVID are so bad that the public health officials and healthcare workers themselves, they had to come out with the dire warning that no one heard because it was on a Saturday, which makes me question as to whether or not it's as bad as it is. And the fact of the matter is, I question some of the data and I question some of the alarm bells that they're setting off because they have now taught me to question what they say. I have no doubt that there are hospitals with people in them. My doubt is whether or not it's being caused by COVID. And the simple idea that, well, if you got vaccinated, you wouldn't end up getting sick and going to the hospital. Sorry, I'm not buying that at all anymore. And I also question whether or not when you tell me, for example, that there was a 700% increase last month in hospitalizations in King County due to COVID, I question whether or not you're telling me the truth. I'm sure that the 700% is true. Remember, if you start really, really small, the percentages don't really matter. You want to get the raw numbers. But pushing that aside, I certainly believe that you're going to get people with COVID in the hospital, but are they there because of COVID? How many stories last month did we get nationally talking about how, oh my God, all these kids are showing up to the hospital with COVID, only to find out, well, no, they're showing up to the hospital for other reasons. They have COVID, but it has nothing to do with why they're in the hospitals. We're talking about the incidental cases. So how many of these are incidental cases? We don't know. They don't tell us. I imagine they have that data, which means if you're not giving it to us, if you're not telling it to us, then I question what you're telling us. Cassie Sauer is with the State Hospital Association. She was on Como, and she was doing the same thing. Hey, better get it vaccinated so we can help alleviate the pressure.
It's really heartbreaking. This just floors me that 30 or 35 people are losing their lives each day in our state to something that's mostly preventable is just stunningly tragic.
Well, COVID is not preventable. What she's saying is that if you were to get vaccinated, you will have a less severe reaction to COVID. And that is true, including with Omicron. That's true. But there are still people who are sick and going to the hospital despite being vaccinated, which they don't really want to talk about. So they say things like this.
It's a really staggering number of cases. It's that, you know, we're at a higher peak than we ever were with Delta, and it continues to limit our hospital's ability to care for patients who need help.
She's right. It is an unbelievable number. Literally. I don't believe all this stuff. I don't believe at least the way that they're talking about it. Should people do the right and responsible thing by going about their lives? Yes. But am I ready to kind of just move on? Yeah. And it is a sad, sad state of affairs that I'm in a position. And you know me, we've been doing this show for a while now during COVID, and I've always been pretty willing to accept good faith attempts by, you know, healthcare workers and public health officials to take them at their word. I don't take them at their word anymore. And if that's happening to me, as someone who I think has been very responsible on air in the way I present information and I'm honest, even when it upsets some of the conservatives who listen, if it's happening to me, I guarantee you it's happening to a lot more people.
The interview.
There's now bipartisan support for a pair of bills that would actually lower taxes. My next guest is a fan. State Representative Drew Stokesbury joins me on the line. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jason.
So you spoke out in support of bills that are being considered right now on the Senate side. It has bipartisan support. Just give me the sort of the 30,000-foot view on this.
Yeah, well, I think there's two really important things to make sure everybody knows. The first and most important is that the state has just an absolutely enormous budget surplus right now. I think the kind of absolute minimum view you could take is that we have an $8.8 billion surplus over the next 3 years. I think if we had access to real-time data based on tax revenue that's coming in, sort of what we call caseloads, which is some certain demands on the budget, and then access to some other accounts, I think you could easily come up with a scenario where we have $13 or $14 billion on the table. So we have a lot of money, all of which is paid for by the taxpayers of Washington State, and I and every other Republican I know of down there is fighting really hard to deliver tax relief to the people of Washington. And that's where the second point comes in, and that is that just last week, a Democrat who represents the district just to the north of me introduced a bill to lower the state sales tax by a percentage point. There are any number of ways one could construct a tax cut. I have two or three bills of my own that would cut taxes in various ways. Several other Republicans have other proposals on the table. Certainly we can argue which one's better than the other, but at some point we can't let perfect be the enemy of good here and leave town without tax relief. So I'm very optimistic that a Democrat would support tax relief like this, and I sure hope it's not just a cheap political election stunt.
Well, that's my question. Is it? And if it's not an election stunt, I look at something like this, and at least to me, it suggests that Democrats are still going to lean in hard to taxing the wealthy and pushing with this capital gains tax. We'll see how the court ends up moving forward, but it feels like they wouldn't be getting rid of the sales tax by a percentage, lowering it by a percentage, if they didn't think they could make up that money somewhere else, even if it's surplus.
You know, that's certainly my fear. In Olympia, we can't really call people's motives into question. It's both against the rules of debate.
I can. You can lean into what I said. It's all good.
But it's also, not necessarily conducive to getting things done. But I think the facts can speak for themselves. This particular senator is from what those folks in the political world would call a swing district. It was previously held by a Republican for several terms. To my knowledge, this state senator has not proposed any other tax cut until suddenly this one was proposed last week. So individuals, I think, are free to draw some inferences from those facts. But, I think time will be the test. The next thing people should look to is whether other Democrats in the state Senate and in my chamber in the state House are interested in putting forward tax proposals or discussing it, at least discussing them, negotiating them. And if the weeks continue to tick by and it's just this one individual with this one bill, then I think signs will increasingly point to it being a political ploy. But I hope that's not the case. I really hope that this is something we can discuss. Working families pay a heck of a lot of money in taxes. Everybody does, but it's probably hardest felt by working families. We hear that rhetoric all the time down in Olympia. You mentioned proposals for taxing the wealthy. That's certainly what we've seen the last couple years. And Democrats have loved to trot out this report showing that Washington has this quote-unquote regressive tax structure. Well, one way, if that's true, to alleviate that, to tax the rich, okay, fine. But an equally valid way to alleviate that concern would be to reduce taxes on the less affluent.
Yeah.
And that is what a sales tax would accomplish. That's what a couple of bills I proposed would accomplish. So I'm not necessarily, I might think A is better than B, but at the end of the day, I'm not so picky as to say that we can't do tax cut B if that's what their support for. So
yeah, and look, if the bill is being proposed with the intention of just so that Senator Mona Das can put it on some campaign mailer, we'll call it out. If there's other Democrats who want to get behind this, we'll certainly support their efforts there. I don't believe in just attacking Democrat senators or House reps for the sake of it. Although sometimes, I'll be honest, it is fun. We've been talking with State Representative Drew Stokesbury. Thank you so much for stopping by, as always. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Jason. Good to hear from you.
Now this.
The Monologue.
On Friday in New York City, in Harlem, two officers were the victims of an ambush attack. An ambush attack that left Jason Rivera dead, just 22 years old, a rookie within the NYPD, and his partner in very critical condition. And I can't say that I'm shocked that it occurred, because we have seen just in New York City alone this month, you saw five officers getting attacked just this month. Last year, overall, the country saw more attacks, deadly attacks on police officers in decades. And it's happening because we allow it. It's happening because we allow it. We allow degenerates like LaShawn McNeil, who's accused of this, to shoot and kill Jason Rivera, allegedly, and shoot and severely injure Wilbert Mora. We allow it. We have given up our cities to criminals. Knowingly. Democrat cities have. But because he used a gun, that's the focus, of course. The governor, Governor Hochul or Hochul, however you say her name, she sent out a tweet about the gun. Not the person who pulled the trigger, but the gun. This is a gun problem. And Mayor Eric Adams, himself a former cop, he was very supportive of the police. He didn't do anything wrong in that regard on the messaging, but he also wanted the federal government to intervene.
We need help from the federal government. We're doing our job in NYPD, taking thousands of guns off the street. Every one they take off, we're having five come in. How do we stop this if the federal government does not stop the flow of guns in this city?
If he thinks the federal government is going to do anything on this problem, he is dreaming. And it shows you, because I don't think he's saying this knowing it's going to fail. I think he is just naive. This is political naivete. The federal government gets involved in going after guns. They're not going after the criminals with guns. They won't even say the term gang because it's racist. They're going to go after law-abiding citizens and their guns, the guns that they own because of the deteriorating circumstances that are occurring across the country in the Democrat-run cities. It's why people are buying guns in such high numbers. The feds are not going to get involved. What you can do can only happen locally, which is to stop people like the Manhattan DA, Alvin Bragg, from giving passes to felonies, to people who otherwise would very easily be convicted of a felony. They get a pass. By getting rid of the policies that allow for cash-free bail, putting bad guys back out on the streets, including those who are incredibly violent, and actually committing to the police, not just in words, but in budgets and in actions. The federal government is not able to do that. They'll never be able to do that. That has to happen locally.
The interview.
Despite knowing that it's damaging to kids, Senate Democrats right now in Olympia are pushing a bill that would allow the State Board of Education to cut one day a week from in-person learning so that students can be put in front of a computer screen that does not give them the same level of education and leads to depression. Joining me on the line to discuss is State Senator Perry Dozier of Walla Walla. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason, very much for having this time to speak with you on this bill.
This is, of course, an absurd position that the Democrats are taking here. Where do things stand on this bill?
Well, there was a tremendous amount of negative testimony on this bill, to tell you. I was really shocked to see this bill even come to the committee, especially after the governor's remarks last week in his State of the State address, and which this bill, it was just counter to some of the remarks that he had made.
Why are they doing this? What is the reason that they give?
Well, the sponsor, the senator sponsor of the bill, Senator Dingra, said she was approached by some students who suggested that this would be an alternative to being in class 5 days a week. We had some of the students actually testify during the bill, but I will tell you they were students that probably were 4-point-plus students, without a doubt, that it wasn't something that was going to impact them as much as the many other students that this would impact.
Yeah, and I think that that's a big issue here. The vast majority of kids are not served in an online learning environment, and unfortunately, we have real-world data that backs that up because we know what it was like for them over the course of this pandemic?
Without a doubt, you know, from the time that we closed the schools down in the spring of 2020, There have been multiple meetings that I have gone to where students have talked about how they dropped from being a near 4-point student to down in the 2-point range, and the issues that they've had with the mental challenges. And we can see this in the test scores. The failure rate of our students is unbelievable, and why we would even entertain anything other than keeping our children in class is just, it's so far-fetched. I couldn't believe that we even were entertaining this bill.
Well, and of course, at the same time, it's a position that's not based in science. If a kid is concerned with COVID, they're concerned not because of what the science says it will do to them, unless, of course, they have a severely immunocompromised system. It's because they've either bought into the fear-mongering that's being done by teachers' unions and in part the media, or they simply don't know what it is they're talking about. It's either or.
Well, the interesting part about this, when they talked about asynchronous learning, if you're even doing online in your home and your teacher is instructing you, it's synchronous learning. Asynchronous means you won't even have a teacher there to do it. You would be basically on your own doing your studying for 20% of the week without teacher involvement. This is where the difficulty, I think, with most people has, is that you're not even being taught. You have that, what I would say, homework time, mm-hmm. or do whatever you want to do time.
It's a horrible idea. So where does this actually stand? Do Democrats back it? Because I imagine Republicans are pretty uniform in saying no.
I have not heard any strong feelings on the Democrat side for this bill to move forward. As I say, it was almost, I'm not even sure if there was one pro testimony on it. When the WEA comes out as other, you know that they aren't pushing forward either. So, again, I don't believe that there's going to be enough support to get it out of committee. And if there is, I would be surprised.
Yeah, well, but fingers crossed that you're right on that.
Time will tell.
Yeah, no kidding. Time will tell. I imagine there might be some folks who would support it but don't want to come out right now and say so, because that would not be very politically astute of them. But, you know, kudos to Senator Monica Dingra, the Democrat behind this, because she's really focusing her priorities on what matters, which in this case, a priority would be to hurt kids and their education. It's so absurd. Thank you so much for the work that you're doing and pushing back. We've been talking with State Senator Perry Dozier of Walla Walla. Thank you so much for stopping by, as always. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks. See you, Jason.
Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz has followed that in detail. He's a radio host in Seattle. He broke this story. He joins us now.
Never shy of his opinion, Jason. Definitely letting you know how he feels about that.
Wow. He laid that down.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
So in a lot of ways, my next guest has completely rejuvenated the whole journalism industry, which is probably why a lot of folks on the left not so fond of the work he does, exposing a lot of the bias and exposing a lot of the stories that folks over at CNN and MSNBC tend to refuse to cover. Joining me on the line to discuss his brand new book, it's called American Muckraker, is James O'Keefe, of course, of Project Veritas. James, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you to discuss this new book, American Muckraker.
Yeah, it's an important topic in the sense of there are a lot of media outlets that kind of just have not evolved with the time. And you use video in ways a lot of people just kind of either refuse to or just won't.
Well, you know, you in journalism these days, it's officials say, according to people familiar with the matter. So there's this information that is given to us by those in power, and we have to question that. We should be skeptical about that. We should focus on printing things that they don't want printed, right? Because mm-hmm. anything else is just public relations. So this book is really a manual, like a Boy Scout manual, on how to do this sort of journalism in clown world, where 2 + 2 = 5, and where the powers that be, the New York Times, the FBI, the big pharmaceutical companies, are working in concert with each other. There's all these guidelines about privacy, ethics, litigation, deception, whistleblowing that we need to understand. I really, it took me 5 years to write this book about all these themes.
Well, in a lot of ways, Trump just broke the media for the most part, even though a lot of these issues that, you talk about and have sort of exploited so that we actually get some better information, it predated the former president. But boy, did they just really lean into these self-defeating strategies during the Trump administration.
Yeah, I mean, there's an anecdote in this book where I talk about Dean Baquet at the New York Times and Jim Rutenberg, who is sort of irrational, logical contortions they flip themselves into. We're not going to cover the president fairly. And that was, things really changed, right, when in 2016 or 2017, the New York Times declared, we are not going to cover a subject fairly. It's an extraordinary admission, certainly a standard they would accuse me of not being fair. And then, as I point out in this book, in chapters on secrecy, privacy, and ethics, they often accuse us of that which they're guilty of. But in the court of law, which is different than the court of rhetoric, we've won effectively. We won a defamation lawsuit against the New York Times, a big victory. So there are ways to hold them accountable. It's not easy. It requires tremendous suffering at times, which is its own theme throughout this book.
I always am in a position where someone is pitching me something to talk about, either on the radio or on Fox News. I imagine you get probably 10 times the amount of tips that I would get. How do you determine, in a world in which a lot of the tips are really, really good, but you only have so much time and energy, how do you determine what you tackle?
Good question. It comes down to first-person observation journalism, so sort of participant journalism, this idea that that you can see it with your own eyes. We don't ask you to trust us. We show you the actual videotape or the actual documents, the actual evidence. And I think that in a world where mendacious innuendo and supposition and half-truths and lies by omission, which is what the newspapers do when they use their words in the way that they use them, mm-hmm. you can kind of break through that with this, what we call cinema verite, which is an old term, but we're using it in a new context. That is to say, you don't have to trust me telling you what happened. You can see it happen. And that's the only way that we trust the information. So one quick example in the book is this interrogation by these federal agents of this whistleblower named Richard Hopkins. And the Washington Post reported that the whistleblower, Richard Hopkins, recanted his testimony, but Hopkins had recorded the federal officials on his phone, and the two things came into conflict, right? The mm-hmm. Washington Post said, according to people familiar with the matter, but the witness had a recording. So increasingly in society, if we have more and more and more of this evidence, firsthand participation evidence, I think that's how we break through the propaganda.
The name of the book is American Muckraker, Rethinking Journalism for the 21st Century. It's out right now. You can go ahead and purchase it right now. We're talking with James O'Keefe. He's the founder of Project Veritas. Does it matter the intent of the person who comes forward with information? So I use an example. Let's just say someone goes after one of the producers at CNN, records them, gives it to you. It sort of starts the conversation. But the only reason they did it was because they went on a bad date, and they're giving you the information. Does any of that matter?
I mean, and to make an argument by analogy, if the cleaning lady in your office unearths a document, doesn't matter what her intent was when she when she gets that document. It's really a situational case by case basis. The thing about verification in journalism is that the thing that separates journalism from any other form of medium like propaganda, like Hollywood filmmaking or anything else, is that you really have to be accurate. So if you're recording someone making a statement, especially in the medium that we use, which is images, the person that made the statement, even if the person is not telling the truth, like, for example, I'll give you a very specific example. Nick Dudick was probably hitting on a girl when he said, this is Nick Dudick, works for the New York Times, and he said, I'm James Comey's godson. Clearly he wasn't, but the fact that he made that up to a stranger and he works for the New York Times to impress them really shine a light on how unethical he was. So in our medium, especially when people are on video, we often report it if they're telling the truth or if they're lying, and let the people decide.
Do you have any fear that folks on the left will do what you do? Or is it a sense of them just being kind of lazy at this point? Because, I mean,
no, I welcome.
Right.
I welcome that. I mean, I welcome that. There's only one truth. My friend Laura Logan says it's better than mm-hmm. I can in her South African accent. there's only one reality. There's only one truth. You're not entitled to multiple realities unless you're an astrophysicist. So if someone wants to go out and record things, as long as you're not breaking the law, and as long as one party consents to the conversation, I welcome it. Of course, my guess, my hypotheses I lay out in this book is that people on the left do not want to record things because they would fly in opposition to the narrative that they present. So, again, one of the most thrilling parts of this book is this interrogation by these Russell Strasser, who is pointing a metaphorical gun at the witness's head and says, "You will recant your testimony. You will recant your testimony. I will scare you." I mean, you would think this is science fiction if it wasn't recorded on tape. And of course, those statements run contrary to what the Washington Post printed. So if you're on the left, and I'm making a generalization, which is pretty safe to make, a lot of these party officials in the Democratic Party are working in symbiosis with CNN and the Washington Post. So they have no interest in going out there and reporting on muckraking, you know, things occurring, because that would run contrary to narrative.
Well, the whole idea of just making sure, and I tell this to folks all the time, is document whatever you can. Obviously, do it in a legal way. But you got to document stories because, look, the truth is, would CRT as a topic be as big right now or has been in the past few months if folks didn't actually record some of the conversations that were happening in the remote classroom? I mean, imagine a kid coming up to a parent saying, "Yeah, my teacher just said we have to dismantle systems of oppression and all white people are racist." Most parents probably would not be thinking that actually occurred. But you must have misheard something. But getting everything documented really does make it harder for the other side to lie, frankly.
And then the whole idea of a deposition, which I've been through many times. For your audience who's not familiar, in litigation, you passed this phase of a lawsuit where you get to depose them. You get to ask them questions under oath on video. And initially, they wanted to intimidate me with this process, because they thought that I keep secrets and they can sort of unearth, you know, dirt about me in these. But what they quickly learned is that we at Veritas, our manner of behavior is we don't behave differently in public than we do in private, which is the most important ethical rule I write about in this book. You have to, if you're going to do what I do, you cannot keep secrets, because you have to operate on the premise that eventually everything will be unearthed. However, they keep many secrets and they do things that are deceptive and they do things that are wrong. And they fear the deposition, and that's why they stopped suing me, because I didn't settle. I go to discovery, and I publish the deposition tapes of them.
Last question for you, just on speaking of the legal stuff that you've been involved in. Obviously, you're in a lawsuit against the New York Times. They say they will be pushing hard because basically a judge said you can't use internal documents provided by your lawyer that they somehow got a hold of in order to print their attacks against you. Here's a legitimate question that I think is fair. Would you run with a comparable set of documents that you somehow got, but had no, you know, you didn't steal them, you didn't do any of that, but that showed, you know, the New York Times is biased in their coverage, and here's the proof?
Yeah, I mean, well, this is very nuanced.
Yeah.
Because we sued them for defamation, and we're both litigants in the same lawsuit. So no, I would not publish the attorney-client privilege memoranda of a plaintiff that I was in litigation with. That's litigation misconduct. It violates the sacred rules of American jurisprudence. And defamation is not protected by the First Amendment. It's established case law in New York Times v. Sullivan. If someone acts with actual malice against a public figure, that is not protected speech, and newspapers do not have a First Amendment right to publish that. The New York Times did that to me. And in that very lawsuit, they published my lawyer memos, which were improperly obtained right after the FBI raid. So in this particular case, the judge in New York ordered them to sequester the memos. They cried foul. They talked about the Pentagon Papers. Give me a break. This is not that.
Well, it's so important just to make that distinction because, you know, when you have the New York Times saying this is about free speech, I was like, no, it could be. There's no doubt. There are certainly avenues that this could go down that would make this about free speech in a more traditional sense. But, I mean, the nuance that you point out is an important aspect of the story that I feel like a lot of folks aren't actually picking up on. In any case, I've been talking with James O'Keefe. He, of course, is the founder of the Project Veritas. You can go online right now, projectveritas.com. Make sure you order American Muckraker, Rethinking Journalism for the 21st Century. James, thank you so much for stopping by. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
I got to say, I was just totally fascinated by the story that was in the New York Times. It was either this morning or maybe it came out yesterday morning, but it's titled, Can Anyone Satisfy Amazon's Craving for Electric Vans? And the whole idea of the story is that Amazon had come out and said, look, we want to be really committed to only using electric vans. We care about the environment, which is funny because I get a small thing of scissors end up mailing to me overnight in a huge box, and we're going to pretend that they're good for the environment. But hey, they're doing what they can. And obviously, if this is where they want to put their investments, I certainly have no problem with it. But what was curious in this piece was they came out and said they were going to buy thousands of these electric Ram vans from a company called Stellantis. This is a new company. It was created out of the merger between Chrysler and I think it's Peugeot, whatever that French automaker is. And they came, Amazon, and they ordered 1,800 electric vans. And they're now saying, where are they? Where are all the vans? Are they getting here at any point? Because they were expected to have about 170,000 of the vans on the road by the end of last year. Unfortunately, they still haven't gotten all of the vans that they wanted. And one of the quotes in this piece from the New York Times was literally Bezos saying, where are our vans? Jeff Bezos. And this was at the time. Because according to this piece, they still haven't gotten everything. They say, according to regulatory disclosures that were put out in November of last year, that the full delivery would happen by 2025. And then Amazon said they expect to have all the vehicles that they're ordering no later than 2030. Now, obviously, they're not up to speed enough, these companies, on creating the product to meet the demand of just Amazon. And the reason why I'm fascinated by the story, and you should go check it out. I gave you sort of a 30,000-foot view on what the story was about. There are lots of important details that were left out. But what's really curious to me isn't that Amazon wants to go in this direction, a company that says they care about the environment. But more importantly for Amazon, I think, is, they believe this is going to be cheaper for them in the long term to do because of the rising gas prices. We have this push coming from the Biden administration and others to move in this direction, get electric vehicles, get the hybrids, go away from the gas guzzling cars because they're bad for the environment. And yet we still at this point don't really have a infrastructure to handle not just the demand in the supply where it exists, but just the literal transportation infrastructure in the states where you would be driving these, or in the cities that you would be driving these. Pushing hard, Inslee is pushing us hard into getting electric vehicles. So let's say you go ahead and buy it, and the difference between the market of creating these consumer electric vehicles versus the business electric vehicles, one is better than the other, right? So when you look at the electrical vehicles being made on the private consumer side versus the business side, it's much better. They've got their acts together in a more significant way. But let's just say tomorrow, lots of people wanted to purchase one of these vehicles if they could find it. The supply chain is causing, pushing that aside. Let's just say tomorrow, people just wanted to buy these cars. Are we ready for that? No. Where would you plug them in? Where would you plug them in? Let's say you live in Seattle or an apartment in Bellevue or Tacoma or Everett. Maybe in some of the newer apartment buildings, there are like two spots that are reserved for electric parking. Maybe you go to, Pacific Place Mall and you've got a few spots that you can plug in. But for the most part, we don't have anywhere to plug in, or very few places to do that. And yet we are being pushed into this direction by a whole bunch of folks who want to determine our consumer habits. And if they're not able to convince us to go this route, they'll just force it upon us anyway. But they are presenting you this pitch while not actually being ready. It almost seems as if they're doing this because they know
that they won't be listened to for a very long time. And, you know, there's truth in that, that, you know, the government comes in, whether it's Inslee or Biden or a Republican, pushing you in this direction in order to change the habits, the consumer spending habits of, you know, hundreds of millions of people. That can take, you know, decades. And so this is maybe that acknowledgement, but it still doesn't seem like there's any meaningful investment in what is a complete, wholly necessary. It's completely necessary to set up if you actually want this to be successful. Now, you know, part of the reason why they're not implementing their infrastructure plans to begin with is, number one, it's really expensive. And number two, I think deep down they know that it's not really the future. The future is going to be some kind of cleaner technology for the gas, or something that doesn't require you to plug in. Something that you can use water, for example, to go ahead and power. Like, all of that technology, the stuff that you and I can't even think of yet, is being developed, is being thought about, is being theorized. And that's going to be the end of all of this nonsense about plugging in your cars. The whole idea of an electric vehicle is just very, also just very kind of old. It just does not see, it's like when, oh, we're going to invest in railroad. Like, okay, there's certainly a market for that, and there's viability as that as a transportation model. But at the same time, as you're now starting to invest in rail, maybe between Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia, there's a whole bunch of different technology using magnets as a means to move people, to transport people. It just seems really odd to me at the lack of reality as to whether or not we're ready for the urgency in which we're being told, hey, you better go ahead and buy these electric vehicles.
The Last Rant.
And with that, I just want to say, can people stop trying to force things down everybody's throats that just because you think it's a good idea, for example, to go in the world of electronic vehicles, doesn't mean it's the right move. You might like it, and you can make a really compelling case on the environmental front, sure. I think you can. But it doesn't mean that people want what it is you're selling. And we have this reluctance in this country, especially our leaders, to fully say, oh, hey, maybe we'll hold back a little bit on what we're trying to push down people's throats, and we'll listen to their feedback. We'll listen to their inaction on a message that we've been very urgently pushing for a while and rethink what our plans are. Like, maybe go back to the drawing board. You have an issue, which is a reasonable one. We want to protect the environment. Totally get it. I do as well. But no one really wants these electronic vehicles at this point, and it's not for a lack of trying on your end. And it's certainly not for a lack of trying on the side of the automakers. There's a market, to be sure, but there's not the mass market that people want or would really need, I should say, in order to get the environmental concerns in order. So why not go back to the drawing board and start thinking about something else? Why can't you just let this idea fail? They refuse. And I think that that's wrong, but it ultimately goes to the narcissism involved. I came up with this idea. It's brilliant. And if you disagree, you're wrong. And I'm going to continue to put my head down and push ahead, trying to get you to adopt things you don't want to adopt. It drives me absolutely nuts. And that's The Last Rant.